He said it was a problem he worried about all the time. How to make sure we were dead before the Russians got their hands on us, and how to kill more Russians after we were dead.
Does Kader know?
No. I'm trying to keep Habib in line. I know where he's coming from, Lin. I've been there. The first couple of years after my family was killed, I was as crazy as he is. I know what's going on inside him. He's filled up with so many dead friends and enemies that he's kind of locked on one course, killing Russians. And until he snaps out of it, I just gotta stay with him as much as I can and watch his ass.
I think you should tell Kader, I sighed, shaking my head.
I will, he sighed in return. I will. Soon. I'll talk to him soon. He'll get better. Habib will get better. He's getting better in some ways. I can talk to him real well now. He'll make it.
But as the weeks of the journey passed, we all watched Habib more closely, more fearfully. And little by little we all realized why so many other Mujahideen units had cast him out. With our senses alert for menace from without and within, we travelled by night, and sometimes by day, north along the mountainous border towards Patan Khel. Near the Khel, or village, we swung north-northwest into deserted mountainous terrain that was veined with cold, fresh, sweet water streams. Habib laid out a route that was roughly equidistant between towns and larger villages, always avoiding the main arteries that local people used. We trudged between Patan Khel and Khairotana, between Humay Karez and Haji Agha Muhammad. We forded rivers between Loe Karez and Yaru. We zigzagged between Mullah Mustafa and the little village of Abdul Hamid. Local pirates, demanding tribute, stopped us three times on the way. Each time they revealed themselves at first in high vantage points, with guns trained on us, before their ground forces swept from hiding to lock the way forward and cut off our retreat. Each time, Kader raised his green and white Mujahideen flag, emblazoned with the Quranic phrase, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. We come from God, and unto God do we return. Although the local clans didn't recognize Kader's standard, they respected its language and intent. Their fierce, belligerent postures remained, however, until Kader, Nazir, and our Afghan fighters explained to them that the group was travelling with, and under the protection of, an American. When the local pirates had examined my passport and stared hard into my blue-grey eyes, they welcomed us as comrades in arms and invited us to drink tea and feast with them. The invitation was a euphemism for the honour of paying them a tribute. Although none of the pirates we encountered wanted to upset the critically important American aid that helped to sustain them in the long years of the war by attacking an American-sponsored caravan, it was unthinkable that we might pass through their territory without providing some plunder. Kader had brought a supply of bakshish goods for that very purpose. There were silks in peacock blue and green, with rich interweavings of gold thread. There were hatchets and thick-bladed knives and sewing kits. There were Zeiss binoculars. Kader had given me a pair, and I used them every day. And magnifying spectacles for reading the Quran, and solid Indian-made automatic watches. And for the clan leaders, there was a small hoard of gold tablets, each weighing one tola, or about 10 grams, and embossed with the Afghan laurel. Kader hadn't merely anticipated those pirate attacks. He'd counted on them. Once the formal courtesies and tribute negotiations were concluded, Kader arranged with each local clan leader to resupply our caravan. The resupply provided us with rations while we were on the move, and also guaranteed us food and animal feed at fraternal villages that were under the control or protection of the clan leader. The resupply was essential. The munitions, machine parts, and medicines that we carried were priorities, and left us little room for surplus cargo. Thus we carried a little food for the horses, 2 days' ration at most, but we carried no food at all for ourselves. Each man had a canteen of water, but it was understood that it was an emergency ration, to be used sparingly for ourselves and the horses. Many were the days we passed with no more than one glass of water to drink, and one small piece of naan bread to eat. I was a vegetarian, without being a fanatic about it, when I started on that journey. For years I'd usually preferred to eat my fruit and vegetable diet when it was available. 3 weeks into the trek, after dragging horses across mountains and freezing rivers, and trembling from hunger, I fell on the lamb and goat meat that the pirates offered us and ripped the flesh half-cooked from the bones with my teeth. The steep mountain slopes of the country were barren, burned of life by the biting wintry winds. But every flat plain, no matter how small, was a vivid living green. There were wildflowers with red starry faces and others with sky-blue pom-pom heads. There were short, scrubby bushes with tiny yellow leaves that the goats enjoyed, and many varieties of wild grasses, topped with feathery bowers of dried seed for the horses. There were lime-green mosses on many of the rocks, and paler lichens on others. The impact of those tender, viridescent carpets between the endlessly undulating crocodile's back of naked stone mountains was far greater than it might have been in a more fertile and equable landscape. We responded to each new sight of a softly carpeted incline or tufted leafy moor with similar pleasure, a deep subliminal response to the vitality in the colour green. More than a few of the tough, hardened fighters, trudging between the walking horses, stooped to gather a little clutch of flowers so that they might simply feel the beauty of them in their dry and calloused hands. My status as Carter's American helped us to negotiate the badlands of the local pirates, but it also cost us a week when we were stopped for the third and last time. In an effort to avoid the little village of Abdul Hamid, our guide, Habib, led us into a small canyon that was just wide enough for three or four horses to ride side by side. Steep rock walls rose up on either side of the canyon trail for almost a kilometre before the funnel opened out into a much longer, wider valley. It was the perfect place for an ambush, and in anticipation, Kader rode at the head of our column with his green and white banner unfurled. The challenge came before we were 100 metres into the gorge. There was a chilling ululation from high above. Men's voices raised in an imitation of the high-pitched, warbling wail of tribal women, and a sudden tumble of small boulders as a little avalanche spilled into the canyon before us. Like others, I turned in my saddle to see that a platoon of local tribesmen had taken up positions behind us with a variety of weapons trained on our backs. We halted immediately at the first sound. Kader slowly rode on alone for some 200 metres. He stopped there, with his back straight in the saddle, and his standard fluttering in the strong, chill breeze. The seconds of a long minute ticked away, with the guns behind us and the rocks poised above. Then a lone figure appeared, riding toward Kader on a tall camel. Although the two-humped Bactrian camel is native to Afghanistan, the rider's was a single-humped Arabian camel, the type bred by long-distance cameleers of the northern Tajik region for use in extremes of cold. It had a mop of hair on its head, thick and shaggy neck fur, and long, powerful legs. The man riding that impressive beast was tall and lean, and appeared to be at least 10 years older than Kader's fit 60+. He wore a long, white shirt over white Afghan pants, and a knee-length, sleeveless black serge vest. A snowy white turban of sumptuous length was piled majestically on his head. His grey-white beard was trimmed away from the upper lip and the mouth, descending from his chin to nudge his thin chest. Some of my friends in Bombay had called that kind of beard a Wahhabi, after the sternly orthodox Saudi Arabian Muslims who trimmed their beards in that way to imitate the style preferred by the Prophet. It was a sign to us in the canyon that the stranger possessed at least as much moral authority as temporal power. The latter was emphasized with spectacular effect by the antique long-barrel jezail that he held upright, balanced on his hip. The muzzle-loaded rifle was decorated all along its wooden surfaces with gleaming discs, scrolls, and diamond shapes fashioned from brass and silver coins and polished to a dazzling brilliance. The man drew up beside Kader Bai, facing us and within a hand's reach of our Khan. His bearing was commanding, and it was clear that he was accustomed to a comprehensive respect. He was, in fact, one of the very few men I ever came to know who equaled Abdelkader Khan in the esteem, perhaps even the veneration, that he commanded from others with nothing more or less than his bearing and the sheer force of his fully realized life. After a lengthy discussion, Kader Bai wheeled his horse gently to face us.
"Mr. John," he called to me,
using the first name in my false American passport and speaking in English.
"Come here to me, please."
I kicked backward, uttering what I hoped was an encouraging sound. All eyes, on the ground and above us, were on me, I knew, and in the swollen, silent seconds, I had a vision of the horse throwing me to the ground at Kader's feet. But the mare responded with a smart, prancing canter, and found her own way through the column to stop at Kader's side.
"This is Haji Mohammed,"
Kader announced. He swept around us with a broad movement of his open palm.
"He is the Khan, the leader of all the people, in all the clans, and all the families here."
"Assalamu alaikum," I said in greeting, holding my hand over my heart as a gesture of respect. Believing me to be an infidel, the leader didn't respond to my greeting. The Prophet Muhammad adjured his followers to return the peaceful greeting of a believer with an even more polite greeting. Thus the greeting, "Assalamu alaikum, peace be with you," should have been answered at the very least with, "Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah," and "with you be peace and the compassion of Allah." Instead, the old man stared down from his perch on the camel and greeted me with a hard question.
"When will you give us stingers to fight with?"
It was the same question every Afghan had asked me, the American, since we'd entered the country. And although Kader Bai translated it for me again, I understood the words, and I'd rehearsed the answer. "It will be soon, if Allah wills it, and the sky will be as free as the mountains." It was a good answer, and Haji Muhammad was pleased with it. But it was a much better question, and it deserved a better response than my hopeful lie. The Afghans, from Mazari Sharif to Kandahar, knew that if the Americans had given them Stinger missiles at the outbreak of the war, the Mujahideen would have beaten the invaders back within months. Stingers meant that the hated and mortally effective Russian helicopters could be smashed from the skies. Even the formidable MiG fighters were vulnerable to a hand-launched Stinger missile. Without the insuperable advantage of the air, the Russians and their Afghan army proxies would be forced to fight a ground war against the Mujahideen resistance. A ground war they could never win. Cynics among the Afghans believed that the Americans refused to supply Stingers for the first 7 years of the conflict because they wanted Russia to win just enough of the Afghan war to overreach and overcommit themselves. If and when the Stingers finally arrived, the Russians would suffer a defeat that cost them so much in men and resources that their entire Soviet empire would collapse. And whether the cynics were right or wrong, the deadly game did play itself out in exactly that way. The Stinger missiles did turn the tide of the conflict when they were finally introduced, a few months after Kader led us into Afghanistan. The Russians were so weakened by the war of resistance fought by those very Afghan villages and millions like them, that their monstrous Caligulan empire crumbled around them. It worked. It played out that way. And what it cost was 1 million Afghan lives. What it cost was 1/3 of the population forced from their homeland. What it cost was one of the largest forced migrations in human history. 3.5 million refugees moving through the Khyber Pass to Peshawar, and 1 million more exiled in Iran, India, and the Muslim republics of the Soviet Union. What it cost was 50,000 men, women, and children, with one or more limbs amputated through landmine explosions. What it cost was the Afghan heart and soul. And I, a wanted criminal, working for a mafia crime lord, impersonated an American and looked those people in the eye and lied to them about the weapons I couldn't give them. Haji Muhammad liked my answer so much that he invited our group to attend the wedding celebrations of his youngest son. Concerned that a refusal might offend the elderly leader, and genuinely touched by the generous invitation, Kader accepted. When all the tributes were exacted, Haji Muhammad drove a hard bargain, demanding and receiving Kader's own horse as an additional personal gift. Kader Bai, Nazir, and I agreed to accompany the leader to his khel. The rest of our column made camp in a pastured valley with plentiful fresh water. The break in our forced march allowed the men to groom and rest the horses. The pack animals were in constant need of attention, and with the cargo concealed in a protected cave, the unburdened beasts were free to gamble and roam. Our men prepared to feast on 4 roasting sheep, aromatic Indian rice, and fresh green leaf tea, provided by Haji's village as their contribution to our part in the jihad. With the practical business of tributes negotiated and received, the senior men of Haji Muhammad's village, like all the Afghan clan leaders we'd encountered on the journey, acknowledged us as fighters in the same cause and offered every help they could provide. As Kader, Nazir and I rode away from the temporary camp towards the khel, the sounds of singing and laughter followed us, echo chasing playful echo. It was the first time we'd heard that lightness of heart from our men in the 23 days of the journey. Haji Muhammad's village was in celebration when we arrived. His profitable, bloodless encounter with our column of armed men had added to the gathering thrill of anticipation for the wedding. Kader explained how the elaborate rituals of Afghan matrimony had been unfolding for months before we'd arrived. There had been ceremonial visits between the family of the groom and the family of the bride. In every case, small gifts such as handkerchiefs or scented sweets had been exchanged, and precise courtesies were observed. The bride's dowry of extravagantly embroidered cloths, imported silks, perfumes, and jewelry had been publicly displayed for all to admire, and was then held in trust for her by the groom's family. The groom had even visited his bride-to-be in secret, and he'd presented her with personal gifts as he spoke to her. According to custom, it was strictly forbidden for him to be seen by the men in her family during that secret visit. But custom also required him to be helped by the girl's mother. The dutiful mother, Kader assured me, had remained with the couple while they spoke to one another for the first time, and had acted as their chaperone. With all that achieved, the couple was ready for the culmination of the marriage ceremony itself, to be held in 3 days' time. Kader took me through the finest details of the rituals, and it seemed to me that there was a kind of urgency in his normally gentle teacher's manner. At first, I guessed, rightly I think, that he was reacquainting himself with the customs of his people, after his 5 long decades in exile. He was reliving the scenes and celebrations of his youth, and he was proving to himself that he was still Afghan, in all that his heart knew and felt. But as the lessons continued through the following days, and the intensity of his attention to them never failed, I finally realized that the long explanations and histories were for my benefit more than his. He was giving me a crash course in the culture of the nation where I might be killed and where my body might be laid to rest. He was making sense of it, my life with him and my possible death, in the only way that he knew. And understanding that, without ever speaking of it to him, I listened dutifully and learned everything I could. Kinsmen, friends, and other invitees streamed into Haji's village during those days. The 4 main houses of Haji Muhammad's fortress-like men's kala, or compound, were tall, square mud-brick buildings. High walls surrounded the kala, and one large dwelling stood in each of the 4 corners. The women's kala was a separate set of buildings behind even higher walls. In the men's compound We slept on the floor and cooked all our own meals. It was already crowded in the house that Kader, Nazir and I joined. But as new men arrived from distant villages, we all simply squashed in further. Sleeping in our clothes, we top and tailed across the whole floor, each man sleeping with his head beside the feet of the next. There's a theory that snoring at night in sleep is a subconscious defense reflex, a warning sound that frightened potential predators away from the mouth of the cave when our lower Paleolithic ancestors huddled in vulnerable sleep. That group of Afghan nomads, cameleers, sheep and goat herders, farmers and guerrilla fighters, lent credibility to the idea, for they snored so thunderously and with such persistent ferocity through the long cold night that they would have frightened a pride of ravenous lions into scattering like startled mice. During the day, the same men prepared complex food dishes for the Friday wedding. Those dishes included flavoured yogurts, piquant goats or sheep's milk cheeses, oven-baked cakes made with corn flour, dates, nuts and wild honey, biscuits baked with richly churned goat's milk butter, and of course, a variety of halal meats and vegetable pulao. While the foods were being prepared, I watched as men dragged a foot-operated grinding wheel into an open space, and the groom devoted a tense hour to putting a razor's edge to a large ornate dagger. The bride's father watched that effort with a critical eye. After satisfying himself that the weapon was suitably lethal, he gravely accepted it as a gift from the younger man.
The groom has just sharpened the knife that the bride's father will use on him if he ever mistreats the girl, Kader explained to me as we watched.
That's a pretty good custom, I mused.
It is not a custom, Kader corrected me with a laugh. It is his idea, the bride's father. I have never heard of it before this. But if it works, it might become a custom.
Each day, the men also rehearsed ritual group dances with the musicians and singers who'd been hired to complement the formal public celebration. The dancing gave me the chance to see a new and completely unexpected side of Nazir. He hurled himself into the whirling chorus line of men with grace and passion. Moreover, my short, bow-legged friend, whose bulky arms seemed to jut outward from the tree trunk of his thick neck and chest, was by far the best dancer in the entire assembly, and quickly earned their admiration. The whole secret and invisible inner life of the man, his full creative and spiritual endowment, was expressed in the dance. And that face, I'd said once that I'd never seen another human face in which the smile was so utterly defeated. That scowl-creased face was transfigured in the dance until his honest, selfless beauty was so radiant that it filled my eyes with tears.
Tell me once more,
Abdelkader Khan commanded, with a roguish smile in his eye, as we watched the dancers from a vantage point beneath a shaded wall. I laughed. When I turned to look at him, he laughed as well.
Go on, he urged. Do it to please me.
But you've heard this 20 times from me already. How about you answer me a question instead?
You tell me once more, and then I will answer your question.
Okay, here goes. The universe began about 15 billion years ago, in almost absolute simplicity. And it's been getting more and more complex ever since. This movement from the simple to the complex is built into the web and weave of the universe, and it's called the tendency toward complexity. We are the products of this complexification, and so are the birds and the bees and the trees and the stars and even the galaxies of stars. And if we were to get wiped out in a cosmic explosion, like an asteroid impact or something, some other expression of our level of complexity would emerge. Because that's what the universe does. And this is likely to be going on all over the universe. How am I doing so far? I waited, but he didn't reply. So I continued with my summary. Okay, the final or ultimate complexity, the place where all this complexity is going, is what, or who, we might call God. and anything that promotes, enhances, or accelerates this movement towards God is good. Anything that inhibits, impedes, or prevents it is evil. And if we want to know if something is good or evil, something like war and killing and smuggling guns to Mujahideen guerrillas, for example, then we ask the question, what if everyone did this thing? Would that help us in this bit of the universe to get there, or would it hold us back? And then we have a pretty good idea whether it's good or evil. What's more important, we know why it's good or evil. There, how was that?
Very good, he said, without looking at me.
While I'd run through the summary of his cosmological model, he'd closed his eyes and nodded his head, pursing his lips in a half-smile. When I concluded it, he turned to look at me, and the smile widened as the pleasure and the mischief sparked in his eyes.
You know, if you wanted to do it, you could express this idea every bit as well and as accurately as I do. And I've been working on it and thinking about it for almost all of my life. I cannot tell you how happy it makes me feel to hear you tell it to me in your own words.
I think the words are yours, Kaderji. You've coached me often enough. But I do have a couple of problems. Do I get my question now?
Yes.
Okay. We've got things like rocks in the world that aren't alive, and living things like trees and fish and people. Your cosmology doesn't tell me where life and consciousness come from. If rocks are made out of the same stuff that people are made out of, how come rocks aren't alive but people are? I mean, where does life come from?
I know you well enough to be sure that you want me to give you a short, direct answer to this question.
I think I'd like a short, direct answer to every question, I replied, laughing. He raised an eyebrow at the foolishness of my flippant response and then shook his head slowly.
Do you know the English philosopher Bertrand Russell? Have you read any of his books?
Yeah, I read some of his stuff at university and in prison.
He was a favorite of my dear Mr. Mackenzie Esquire, Carter smiled. I do not often agree with Bertrand Russell's conclusions, but I do like the way he arrives at them. Anyway, he once said, anything that can be put in a nutshell should remain there. And I do agree with him about that. But now, the answer to your question is this. Life is a feature of all things. We could call it a characteristic, which is one of my favorite English words. If you do not speak English as your first language, the word characteristic has an amazing sound, like rapping on a drum or breaking kindling wood for a fire. To continue, every atom in the universe has the characteristic of life. The more complex way that atoms get put together, the more complex is the expression of the characteristic of life. A rock is a very simple arrangement of atoms. So the life in a rock is so simple that we cannot see it. A cat is a very complex arrangement of atoms. So the life in a cat is very obvious. But life is there in everything, even in a rock, and even when we cannot see it.
Where did you get this idea? Is it in the Quran?
Actually, it is a concept that appears in one way or another in most of the great religions. I have changed it slightly to suit what we have learned about the world in the last few hundred years. But the Holy Quran gives me my inspiration for this kind of study, because the Quran commands me to study everything and learn everything in order to serve Allah.
But where does this life characteristic come from? I insisted, sure that I had him trapped in a reductionist dead end at last.
Life and all the other characteristics of all the things in the universe, such as consciousness and free will and the tendency toward complexity, and even love,
was given to the universe by light, at the beginning of time as we know it.
At the Big Bang, is that what you're talking about?
Yes. The Big Bang expansion happened from a point called a singularity. Another of my favorite five-syllable English words. That is almost infinitely dense and almost infinitely hot, and yet it occupies no space and no time, as we know those things. The point is a boiling cauldron of light energy. Something caused it to expand. We don't know yet what caused it. And from light, all the particles and all the atoms came to exist, along with space and time and all the forces that we know. So, light gave every little particle at the beginning of the universe a set of characteristics. And as those particles combine in more complex ways, the characteristics show themselves in more and more complex ways.
He paused, watching my face as I struggled with the concepts and questions and emotions that looped in my mind. He got away from me again, I thought, suddenly furious with him for having an answer to my question, and yet struck with admiring respect for the same reason. There was always something eerily incongruous in the wise lectures, sometimes they were like sermons, of the mafia don Abdelkader Khan. Sitting there against a stone wall, in an all but Stone Age village in Afghanistan, with a cargo of smuggled guns and antibiotics nearby, the dissonance created by his calm, profound discourse about good and evil, and light and life and consciousness, was enough to fill me with exasperated irritation.
What I have just told you is the relationship between consciousness and matter,
Kader proclaimed, pausing again until he had my eye.
This is a kind of test, and now you know it. This is a test that you should apply to every man who tells you that he knows the meaning of life. Every guru you meet, and every teacher, every prophet, and every philosopher, should answer these two questions for you. What is an objective, universally acceptable definition of good and evil? And what is the relationship between consciousness and matter? If he cannot answer these two questions, as I have done, you know that he has not passed the test.
How do you know all this physics? I demanded. All this about particles and singularities and big bangs. He stared at me, reading the full measure of the unconscious insult. How is it that an Afghan gangster like you knows so much about science and higher knowledge? I looked back at him, remembering a day at the slum with Johnny Cigar, when I'd made the cruel mistake of assuming him to be ignorant, simply because he was poor.
There is a saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Do you know it?
He asked, laughing. It seemed that he was laughing at me rather than with me.
Yes, I whistled patiently through clenched teeth.
Well, just at the point in my studies of philosophy and religion, when I came to need the special knowledge of a scientist, one appeared for me. I knew that there were many answers for me in the science of life and stars and chemistry. But unfortunately, these were not the things that my dear Mackenzie Esquire taught to me, except in the most elementary fashion. Then I met a physicist, a man who was working at the Baba Atomic Research Center in Bombay. He was a very good man, but he had a weakness for gambling at that time. He found himself in big trouble. He lost a lot of money that was not his to lose. He was gambling at one of the clubs owned by a man I knew well, a man who worked for me if I needed it. And there was more trouble. The scientist was involved with a woman. He fell in love with her, and he did stupid things for the sake of this love, and so there were many dangers. When he came to me, I solved the problems of this scientist and kept all the matters strictly between us. No one else ever knew the details of his indiscretions or of my involvement in solving them. And in exchange for this, the man has been teaching me ever since that day. His name is Wolfgang Persis, and I have arranged it that you will meet him, if you wish, soon after we return.
How long has he been teaching you?
We have been studying together once every week for the past 7 years.
Jesus, I gasped, thinking with a little curl of mean delight that wise and mighty Kader hacked out his pound of flesh when it suited him. In another heartbeat, I was ashamed of the thought. I loved Kader Khan enough to follow him into a war. Wasn't it possible that the scientist loved him just as well? And in thinking that, I knew that I was jealous of the man, the scientist I didn't know and probably would never meet. Jealousy, like the flawed love that bears it, has no respect for time or space or wisely reasoned argument. Jealousy can raise the dead with a single spiteful taunt, or hate a perfect stranger for nothing more than the sound of his name.
You are asking about life, Kader said gently, changing tack, because you are thinking about death. And you are thinking about the taking of a life, if it happens that you must shoot a man. Am I right in this?
Yeah, I muttered. He was right, but the killing that preoccupied me wasn't in Afghanistan. The life I wanted to take was perched on a throne, in a secret room in a grotesque brothel called the Palace in Bombay. Madame Jo.
Remember, Kader said insistently,
resting his hand on my forearm to emphasize his words.
Sometimes it is necessary to do the wrong thing for the right reasons. The important thing is to be sure that our reasons are right and that we admit the wrong, that we do not lie to ourselves and convince ourselves that what we do is right.
And later, as the wedding whirled and clamoured to the last wail of its rejoicing, and as we rejoined our men and scrambled, clattered and strained our way across new mountains, I tried to unwind the wreath of thorns that Kader had coiled around my heart with his words. The wrong thing for the right reasons. Once before he'd tormented me with that phrase. I chewed at it in my mind, as a bear will chew at a leather strap that binds it by the leg. In my life, the wrong things were almost always done for the wrong reasons. Even the right things that I did were too often goaded by the wrong reasons. A gloomy mood enwrapped me. It was a sullen, doubting temper that I couldn't shake off. And as we rode into the winter, I often thought of Anand Rao, my neighbour from the slum. I remembered Anand's face smiling at me through the metal grille of the visitor's room at Arthur Road Prison. That gentle, handsome face, so serene, and softened with the peace that had suffused his heart. He'd done the wrong thing for the right reasons, as he saw it. He'd calmly accepted the punishment that he'd earned, as he said to me, as if it was a privilege or a right. And at last, after too many thinking days and nights, I cursed Anand. I cursed him to drive him from my mind, because a voice kept telling me, my own voice, or maybe it was my father's, that I would never know that peace. I would never come to that Eden in the soul, where acceptance of punishment and acknowledgement of wrong and right roll away the troubles that lodge like stones in the barren field of an exiled heart. Moving north again at night, we climbed and crossed the narrow Khusa Pass in the Hadar Mountains. The journey of 30 crow kilometres was closer to 150 climbing and descending kilometres for us. Then, exposed to the wide sky, we travelled over flatter land for almost 50 kilometres to cross the Arghastan River and its tributaries three times before we reached the foothills of the Shabad Pass. And there, with my mind still choked on its rights and wrongs, we were fired on for the first time.
Kader's command that we commence the climb of the Shabad Pass without a rest saved many lives, including my own, that cold evening. We were exhausted after the headlong trotting march across the open plain. Every man among us hoped for rest at the foothills of the pass, but Kader urged us on, riding the length of the column and shouting for us to keep on, and keep up the pace. Thus we were moving fast when the first shots were fired. I heard a sound, a hollow metal tapping, as if someone was rapping on the side of an empty gasoline can with a piece of copper pipe. Stupidly, I didn't associate it with gunfire at first, and I kept trudging forward, leading my horse by the reins. Then the bullets found their range, and they smashed into the ground, our column, and the rock walls around us. The men scrambled for cover. I fell to the ground, grinding my face into the dust of the stony path, and telling myself that it wasn't really happening, that I hadn't seen the man in front of me ripped open across his back as he stumbled forward. Our men began firing from all around me, and rapid breathing the dust into my mouth, stiff with fear, I was in the war. I might have stayed there, with my face in the dirt and my heart thumping seismic terror into the earth, if it wasn't for my horse. I'd lost the reins, and the horse was rearing in fright. Fearing that it might trample me, I scrambled to my feet and scrabbled at the flailing reins to regain control of her. The horse that had been so impressively obedient to that point was suddenly the worst of the entire column. She reared and then bucked. She stamped her hooves and tried to drag me backward. She thrashed and drove us in tight circles, trying to find an angle where she could kick backward at me. She even bit me, snapping at my forearm and causing intense pain through three layers of clothes. I glanced along the line, left and right. Those nearest to the pass were making a run for it, leading their animals toward the rocky shelves for shelter. Those immediately in front of me and behind me had managed to bring their horses down, and they crouched beside or behind them. Only my horse was still rearing and widely visible. Without a horseman's skill, it's a damn hard thing to convince a horse to lie down in a battle zone. Other horses were screaming in fear, and each whinny of terror put more panic into mine. I wanted to save her, to bring her down and make less of a target of her, but I was afraid for myself as well. The enemy fire slammed into the rocks above and beside me, and with every shattering sound, I flinched like a deer nudging a thorn hedge. It's a bizarre feeling waiting for a bullet to strike. The nearest experience I can recall that's anything like it is falling through space and waiting for the safety chute to open. There's a special taste, a unique taste. There's a different smell on your skin. And there's a hardness in the eyes, as if they're suddenly made of cold metal. Just when I decided to give up and let the animal fend for herself, she buckled easily and followed my dragging arms down and onto her side. I hurled myself down with her, using her swollen middle as a shield. In an attempt to calm her, I reached over to pat at her shoulder. My hand squelched in a bloody wound. Raising my head, I saw that the horse had been struck twice, once high on the shoulder and once in the belly. The wounds were streaming blood with every heaving breath, and the horse was crying. I have no other word for it. The sound was a breathy, stuttering, whining sob. I put my head against hers and wrapped my arm around her neck. The men in my group concentrated their fire on a ridge about 150 meters away. With my body pressed hard against the ground, I peeked over the mane of my horse to see dusty plumes rise and spill over the distant ridge as bullet after bullet rammed into the earth. And then it was over. I heard Kader shouting in three languages for the men to stop shooting. We waited for long minutes, in a stillness that groaned and moaned and sobbed. I heard footsteps crunching the stones nearby, and looked up to see Khaled Ansari running toward me at a crouch.
"Are you okay, Lynn?"
"Yeah," I answered, wondering then for the first time if I too had been shot. I ran my hands over my legs and arms. "Yeah, I'm all here. I think I'm still in one piece. But they shot my horse. She's..."
"I'm doing a count,"
he interrupted me, holding up the palms of both hands to calm me and stop me speaking.
Kader sent me to see if you're okay and do a head count. I'll be back soon. Stay here and don't move.
But she's...
She's finished, he hissed,
and then softened his tone.
The horse is gone, Lynn. She's done for. She's not the only one. Habib's going to finish them off. Just stay here and keep your head down. I'll be back.
He ran off at a crouch, stopping here and there along the column behind me. My horse was breathing hard, whimpering with every third or fourth chugging breath. The flow of blood was slow, but steady. The wound in her belly was oozing a dark fluid that was darker than blood. I tried to soothe her, stroking her neck. And then I realized that I hadn't given her a name. It seemed grievously cruel somehow for her to die without a name. I searched my mind, and when I pulled the net of thought up from the blue-black deep, there was a name, glittering and true.
I'm going to call you Claire, I whispered into the mare's ear. She was a beautiful girl. She always made me look good wherever we went. When I was with her, I always looked like I knew what I was doing. And I didn't start to love her, really, until she walked away from me for the last time. She said I was interested in everything and committed to nothing. She said that to me once, and she was right. She was right.
I was babbling, raving, in shock. I know the symptoms now. I've seen other men under fire for the first time. A rare few know exactly what to do. Their weapons are returning fire before their bodies have finished an instinctive crouch and roll. Others laugh and can't stop laughing. Some cry and call for their mama or their wife or their god. Some get so quiet, shrinking down inside themselves, that even their friends get spooked by it. And some talk, just like I talked to my dying horse. Habib scrambled up to me in a slithering zigzag run and saw me talking into the mare's ear. He checked her over thoroughly, running his hands over the wounds and probing under the thickly veined hide to feel for the bullets. He pulled his knife out of its scabbard. It was a long knife with a dog's tooth point. He positioned it over the horse's throat and then paused. His mad eyes met mine. There was a sunburst of gold around the pupils of his eyes that seemed to pulse and whirl. They were big eyes, but the madness in them was bigger, straining and bulging at them, as if it wanted to burst outward from his very brain. And yet he was sane enough to sense my helpless grief and to offer me the knife. It may be that I should have taken the knife and killed the horse, myself. Maybe that's what a good man, a committed man, would have done. I couldn't. I looked at the knife and the trembling throat of the horse, and I couldn't do it. I shook my head. Habib pushed the knife into the horse's neck and gave it a subtle, almost elegant twist of his wrist. The mare shuddered, but allowed herself to be calm. When the knife left her throat, the blood gushed in heart-thrusted bursts onto her chest and the sodden ground. Slowly, the straining jaw relaxed, and the eyes glazed over, and then the great heart was still. I looked from the gentle, dead, unfearing eyes of the horse into the sickness that careered in Habib's eyes, and the moment that we shared was so charged with emotion, so surreally alien to the worlds I knew, that my hand slid involuntarily along my body to the gun in my holster. Habib grinned at me, a toothy baboon grin that was impossible to read, and scrambled away along the line to the next wounded horse.
Are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? What? I said, are you okay?
Khaled asked, shaking a handful of clothing at my chest until I looked him in the eye.
Yeah, sure.
I focused on his face, wondering how long I'd been staring at my dead horse, with my hand resting on her punctured throat. I looked around me at the sky. The night was close, only minutes away. How bad was it? We lost one man, Majid, a local guy.
I saw it. He was right in front of me. The bullets cut him open like a can opener. Fuck, man, it was so quick. He was alive, and then his back opened up and he dropped over like a cut puppet. I'm sure he was dead before his knees hit the ground. It was that fast.
Are you sure you're okay? Khaled asked when I paused for breath.
Of course I'm fucking okay,
I snapped, a purely Australian accent punching into the expletive. The gleam in his eyes goaded me for another heartbeat of vexation, and I almost shouted at him. But then I saw the warmth in his expression and the concern. I laughed instead. Relieved, he laughed with me.
Of course I'm okay, and I'd be a lot better if you'd stop asking me. I'm just a bit talkative, that's all. Give me some slack. Jesus, a man just got killed on one side of me, and my horse got killed on the other side. I don't know whether I'm lucky or jinxed.
You're lucky, Khaled answered quickly. His tone was more serious than his laughing eyes. It's a mess, but it could have been worse.
Worse?
They didn't use anything heavy. No mortars, no heavy machine guns. They would have used them if they had them, and it would have been a lot worse. That means it was a small patrol, probably Afghans, not Russians, just testing us out or trying their luck. As it is, we've got 3 wounded and we lost 4 horses.
Where are the wounded guys?
Up ahead, in the pass. You want to take a look at them with me?
Sure, sure. Give me a hand with my gear.
We wrenched the saddle and bridle from my dead horse and trotted up the line of men and horses to the mouth of the narrow pass. The wounded men were lying within the cover of a shoulder of rock. Kader stood nearby, frowning watchfully at the plain behind me. Ahmed Zadeh was gently but hurriedly removing the clothing from one of the wounded men. I glanced at the darkening sky. One man had a broken arm. His horse had fallen on him when it was shot. The break was a bad one, a compound fracture of the forearm, near the wrist. One bone protruded at a sickeningly unnatural angle, but it remained within the envelope of flesh and nowhere pierced the skin. It had to be set. When Ahmed Zadeh removed the second man's shirt, we saw that he'd been shot twice. Both bullets were still in his body, and they were too deep to reach without major surgery. One, in the upper chest, had shattered the collarbone, and the other had lodged in his stomach, tearing a wide and undoubtedly fatal wound from hip to hip. The third man, a farmer named Siddiqui, had a bad head wound. His horse had thrown him against the rocks, and he'd struck a boulder with the top of his head near the crown. It was bleeding, and there was a clear fracture of the cranium. My fingers slid along the ridge of broken bone, greasy wet with his blood. The broken scalp had split into 3 chunks. One of them was so loose that I knew it would come away in my hand if I tugged at it. His matted hair was all that held his skull together. There was also a thick swelling at the base of the skull, where his head met his neck. He was unconscious, and I doubted that he would ever open his eyes again. I glanced at the sky once more. There was so little daylight left, so little time. I had to make a decision, a choice, and help one man to live, maybe, while I let other men die. I wasn't a doctor, and I had no experience under fire. The work had fallen to me, it seemed, because I knew a little more than the next man, and I was willing to do it. It was cold. I was cold. I was kneeling in a sticky smear of blood, and I could feel it soaking through the knees of my pants. When I looked up at Kader, he nodded, as if he was reading my thoughts. Feeling sick with guilt and fear, I pulled a blanket over Siddiqui to keep him warm. And then I abandoned him, to work on the man with the broken arm.
Khaled pulled open the comprehensive first aid kit beside me. I threw a plastic bottle of antibiotic powder, antiseptic wash, bandages and scissors on the ground at Ahmedzadeh's feet, beside the man who'd been shot. I snapped out brief instructions for cleaning and dressing the wounds, and as Ahmed went to work, covering the bullet wounds, I turned my attention to the broken arm. The man spoke to me urgently. I knew his face well. He had a special talent for herding the unruly goats, and I'd often seen the temperamental creatures following him, unbidden, as he wandered around our camp.
What did he say? I didn't get it.
He asked you if it's going to hurt,
Khaled muttered, trying to keep his voice and his expression reassuringly neutral.
I had this happen to me once, I said in reply. Something just like this. I know exactly how much it hurts. It hurts so much, brother, that I think you should take his gun away.
Right,
Khaled replied.
Fuck.
He smiled broadly and brushed at the ground beside the wounded man, gradually easing the Kalashnikov out of the man's hand and out of reach. Then, as darkness closed over us, and five of the man's friends held him down, I wrenched and twisted his shattered arm until it resembled the straight, healthy limb that it once had been and never would be again.
Allah! Allah!
He shouted, over and over through clenched teeth. When the break was wrapped and set with hard plastic splints, and we'd patched over the wounds on the man who'd been shot, I hastily wrapped a dressing around unconscious Siddiqui's head. At once we set off into the narrow pass. The cargo was distributed among all the remaining horses. The man with the bullet wounds rode a horse, supported on both sides by his friends. Siddiqui was strapped across one of the pack horses, as was the body of Majid, the Afghan who'd been killed in the attack. The rest of us walked. The climb was steep but short. Puffing hard in the thin air and shivering in a cold that penetrated to my bones, I pushed and dragged the reluctant horses with the rest of the men. The Afghan fighters never once complained or grumbled. When the pitch of one climb was steeper than anything I'd known on the whole trip, I paused at last, panting heavily to regain my strength. Two men turned to see that I'd halted, and they slid down the path to me, giving up the precious meters they'd just gained. With huge smiles and encouraging claps on the shoulder, they helped me to drag a horse up the slope, and then bounded off to help those ahead.
"These Afghans may not be the best men in the world to live with,"
Ahmedzadeh puffed as he struggled up the scrambling trail behind me.
"But they are certainly the best men in the world to die with."
After 5 hours of the climb, we reached our destination, a camp in the Shari Safa Mountains. The camp was sheltered from the air by a prodigious ledge of rock. The ground beneath had been excavated to form a vast cave leading to a network of other caves. Several smaller, camouflaged bunkers surrounded the cave in a ring that reached to the fringe of the flat, rugged mountain plateau. Kader called us to a halt in the light of the rising full moon. His scout, Habib, had alerted the camp to our arrival, and the Mujahideen were waiting for us, and the supplies we brought, with great excitement. A message was sent back to me in the center of the column that Kader wanted me. I jogged forward to join him.
"We will ride into the camp, along this path. Khaled, Ahmed, Nazir, Mahmoud, and some others. We do not know exactly who is in the camp. The attack on us at Shabad Pass tells me that Asmatullah Achaksai has changed sides again and joined the Russians. The pass has been his for 3 years, and we should have been safe there. Habib tells me that the camp is friendly, and that these are our own men waiting for us. But they are still behind cover, and they will not come out to greet us. I think it will be better for us if our American is riding with us near the front, behind me. I cannot tell you to do this. I can only ask it.